PRI centraron sus ataques contra Andrés Manuel López Obrador, quien es el favorito en la intención de voto.
¿Yo qué culpa tengo de que estén ustedes empatados?
Andrés,
empatados hasta
70 mil pobres.
Hasta abajo.
Sobre tu conciencia.
Hasta abajo. Y piensan que aquí en el debate van a remontar 30 puntos que les llevo. O sea, yo entiendo, pues, estén desesperados, pero serénense.
No. Anaya acusó a López Obrador de haber pactado con Enrique Peña Nieto para reforzar los ataques en su contra, pues se le acusa de lavado de dinero. Prometió que de llegar a la presidencia enviará a la cárcel a Peña y a Mitt. El candidato puntero dijo que es el panista el que ha tenido múltiples reuniones con Peña.
Aquí estás con Peña.
¿Puedo terminar?
Candidato Anaya, es tiempo de réplica del candidato
sí,
López Obrador.
Es que él también se no lo he visto con Peña.
No
y
lo he visto
con Peña.
En 6 años.
¿Pactaste
no lo
con
he visto.
Él sí o no?
No.
Claro,
candidato no, Anaya, es tiempo de réplica del candidato López
no,
Obrador.
No, no he pactado con él, no lo he visto en 6 años, y tú te has reunido con él.
Y le ofreciste impunidad.
En un año te
reuniste. Y le ofreciste impunidad.
¿Me dejas?
Tiempo.
En un año se reunió 6 veces.
López Obrador volvió a repetir que cancelará la reforma educativa a la que defendió Mitt, quien también amenazó con tener mano dura para los maestros de la Coordinadora Nacional de Trabajadores de la Educación, a los que acusó de violentos. Mitt dijo que el liderazgo vende plazas, pero el aspirante de Morena lo refutó.
El único que vende plazas es el secretario de Educación, que es de ustedes, de la mafia del poder. Ese vendió la plaza de toros de Aguascalientes cuando fue gobernador. Los maestros no venden plazas.
Anaya, quien junto a su partido Acción Nacional ha aprobado todas las reformas neoliberales del gobierno priista, acusó a José Antonio Mitt por haber ignorado, como secretario de Energía, advertencias sobre la ilegalidad de un contrato firmado por la paraestatal Pemex y una empresa de Odebrecht. Al final del debate, los 4 aspirantes pidieron el voto de los mexicanos el 1 de julio.
Vamos a hacer historia, no tengamos miedo, vamos a construir una auténtica democracia.
Gracias, candidato López Obrador. Toca el turno, 1 minuto, candidato Rodríguez Calderón.
Vota Bronco, vota independiente, atrévete, quítate la pata del pescuezo.
El candidato José Antonio Mitt, adelante.
Les pido su voto. Conmigo a ti te va a ir muy bien. Vamos a ganar. ¡Que viva México!
Candidato Anaya, 1 minuto de cierre.
Yo quiero un México en paz. Y quiero que juntos, a golpes de esfuerzo y de amor por la patria, lo hagamos realidad.
Los líderes de Bolivia y Rusia aumentan sus lazos comerciales con más exploración del gas boliviano. Julia Muriel Domenzain viene con los detalles.
En concreto, se trata del aumento de la extracción de gas. Vamos a escuchar qué vías han propuesto los líderes para reforzar su cooperación.
Se discuten las posibilidades de ampliar nuestra cooperación en el ámbito técnico-militar. Suministramos equipo automovilístico y productos farmacéuticos y tenemos la oportunidad de diversificar la variedad de artículos. Gazprom trabaja en 2 yacimientos y la producción de gas es de 2.500 millones de metros cúbicos. Ahora se aborda la cuestión de la extracción de gas, que podría duplicarse.
Quiero decirle, hermano presidente, que saludo el trabajo entre dos países, los técnicos, en tema del gas, pero también importante avanzar en tema del litio. También estamos informados que usted está impulsando la comunidad económica euroasiática. Quisiéramos ser parte de esta integración económica y quién sabe organizar comisión de alto nivel para trabajar conjuntamente, orientado a llegar a un tratado.
En su declaración conjunta, ambos mandatarios han llamado a la comunidad internacional a luchar juntos contra el terrorismo. En particular, han denunciado la financiación de los grupos radicales. Además, han indicado que es inaceptable intervenir en los asuntos internos de otros países con fines geopolíticos bajo el pretexto de la lucha contra el terrorismo. Asimismo, han denunciado las sanciones unilaterales que se aplican fuera de la jurisdicción de los países que las introducen. Tanto Rusia como Bolivia han apostado por la solución pacífica y diplomática de todos los conflictos. Durante la reunión, Evo Morales ha agradecido la cálida bienvenida de parte de Rusia y ha invitado a Vladimir Putin a visitar Bolivia.
Respecto a la madre tierra, quisiéramos ser parte.
aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Porque su voz
es la que cuenta. Bienvenidos a Nuestra Voz.
Todos los jueves de 8:30 a 10 de la noche por el 90.7 FM. Escuche Nuestra Voz, programa de actualidad, información, análisis, cultura, salud y educación, donde su voz es la que cuenta, con líneas abiertas para sus preguntas y comentarios. Recuerde, todos los jueves de 8:30 a 10 de la noche, Nuestra Voz, aquí por el 90.7 FM, kpfk.org.
El Quijote es la gran figura libertaria.
Hello everyone, this is Camilo Mejía, war resistor, conscientious objector, pacifist, political activist, and former political prisoner. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz on 101 FM.
And welcome to another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. Today is June 14th, 2018. Today is the day when we had a protest at the Parks and Rec Department on Church Street and perhaps a number of other spots around the town regarding the absence of open or accessible bathrooms to the entire community, but particularly impacting the homeless community. And because of this protest, I'm creating pretty much a flashback show. In other words, I'm replaying a show from January 7th, 2001, which the majority of the show is taken up with an interview from Chris Connelton, I believe that's his name, who is a teacher and also a supporter of ending the sleeping ban in the controversy around the coffee klatch harassment of peaceful petitioners who were at the city council offices during the winter of 2000 trying to get, lobby the mayor and the city council to get an audience with them to talk about suspending the sleeping ban over the winter, which is kind of what happened this year, although there have been reports of increased ticketing and harassment by Andy Mills' police force now in 2018. But back in 2001, there was a liberal mayor, supposedly a green mayor, actually, the only Green Party mayor ever elected here, Tim Fitzmaurice, who's a UCSC instructor, poet, nice enough guy if you would meet him on the street, but particularly concerned with power and privileges of his office and decorum, and he went after activists very harshly. He created decorum rules that are still posted in city council offices and the police department, which are both unconstitutional and ignored by at least activists like myself, such as you're not allowed to record with an audio recorder while you speak to a member of the staff, which you are. You have to simply be explicit about what you're doing, and they can always refuse to talk to you if they want. That's fine. But as a member of the public, you have the right to make the best record of communications with the government that you're engaged in. So this is mainly, as I said, taken up with Chris Connelton's interview with Tim Fitzmaurice, who spoke to him and his students. I'm not sure where Chris was teaching, but he gave me a long interview on this show. We don't get to hear the first half hour of the show, but that doesn't involve Chris. It involves other discussions, which if you want to, you can actually go back to and hear the original show, which is archived on the Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website at huffsantacruz.org. Just give me a call at 423-4833, and I'll, you know, walk you through it. Or just go back to the oldest archives and look for the January 7th, 2001 show, and you'll find it. Bit of history for those of you who lived through it. Perhaps something of interest for those of you who didn't, and perhaps not. I don't know. It depends on really what your tastes are. The same issues are happening today, even though we have a rent freeze happening and a rent control initiative on the ballot. At the city council meeting 2 days ago, the city expressed an intention, city majority, the Terrazas majority, Mayor Terrazas' majority on the city council, to press forward with essentially a gutting of any rent control prospects by a sort of token measure, assuming, of course, that the rent control initiative fails in November, which I hope it won't. Anyway, that's the intro for this particular show. Again, it's going to start rather abruptly, but then it continues to the end, and I hope you enjoy it. I hope you show up for the protest, or hope you showed up for the protest, and for the Conscience in Action group that is formed to raise issues in a more high-profile way than we've seen in Santa Cruz recently. There's a lot of stuff happening. The library is going to be buried under a parking structure, it looks like. Farmers Market is going to be displaced over to a structure on Front Street. All kinds of developers are getting nice little yummy plums, while real concerns and shelter for not just homeless people, but housing and rents are being largely ignored by the council. Now, they did pass a rent freeze under pressure from the from the fact that the rent control initiative was going to make it on the ballot, so they had to do something to stop landlords from going ape shit. But there's still a huge amount of pressure going on, and it's a huge institutionalized reactionary majority, not just on the city council, but in the staff. So, listen on, and if you want to hear the outcome of the protests that happened today, you can tune in on Sunday at 9:30 when I'll be doing another edition of this show.
Temporary cancellation of the sleeping ban for the winter as an emergency measure, just as Keith Sugar had suggested 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he was responding to this, and that's what this tape is.
Well, how long is this tape?
I think the tape might be a half hour, but the juicy parts that are more interesting for our context here, I think, are in the first 5 minutes, and it's cued and ready.
Well, let's begin playing this tape, and maybe if I know you have to leave shortly, but maybe you could make, if you want to interrupt with a few clarifications and comments as to what's going on, we can see how that works. We can't play this tape in the usual clear, high-tech way that we would play normal tapes, since this is a micro tape, but bear with us. We're going to still try to do it anyway.
Mr. Norris's position, and he counts to forward a completely original and different way. And he absolutely has the opposite impact of what he intends to have. But he has no concept of where the votes are in this particular matter. So that's absolutely wrong. But, you know, let's assume that, you know, he would bring it forward and tell people to vote one way or another. My sense is that even given the current situation, you would still have to have language that people would find acceptable that would respond to the issues. I don't count the forward what he has. And that's what I have to do as a city council.
So, how many citizens would you need to come in support of repealing the sleeping ban for it to seem like something that the community wanted? What would it take for you as a council member and a representative to feel like you were going to be doing what the city wanted you to do? Who is it that has been telling you this isn't what you should do, and that's why you're not willing to make a politically unsuccessful choice by making a motion like that?
A politically unsuccessful choice is not a small matter in this community where we just lost a ballot measure that I authored to try to get support for the family shelter. When you're talking about making a politically unsuccessful choice and driving a politics that tends to divide the community along this particular issue and does not allow you to pass a ballot measure where I think we had 80% of the public on our side, That's a big choice to make, just to die gloriously, just so that you can say, I'm a person of conscience and integrity, doesn't necessarily serve a hot meal to anybody or give anybody a place to sleep. And so it's not a small matter to say, let's make a politically unsuccessful, glorious, you know, idealistic move in this case. So I don't, you know, that's exactly why Mr. Norse and I are odds on this issue, because he would love to see us batting our heads against the wall. Because the only people that suffer are the people that are actually trying to get these other services. I would rather house one person than satisfy. And I would tell you essentially that most of the, you know.
So he said, I would rather house one homeless person than satisfy, and then he just trailed off right there.
What do you think he was trailing off from, Chris?
I think he was keeping himself from saying, then satisfy Mr. Norse.
Well, what's interesting is he went on about a great length about a politically unsuccessful choice. That was one of the many questions you put. You had actually a compound four questions that you were asking him about, like how many citizens was it going to take for you to get this issue forward. It wouldn't be a politically unsuccessful in the sense that he had three votes for the safe sleeping zones. The same three people are on the council, and then he had at least two more: Emily Riley and Ed Porter, probably Scott Kennedy. So that's a total of 6 out of 7 votes, or 5 out of 7 votes, or at least 4 out of 7 votes. He claimed he couldn't count the votes.
Well, he also said that he wouldn't vote for it.
Oh, he said he wouldn't vote
he
for it.
He said he wouldn't vote for it.
Is that on this tape, or is that before?
He said it.
Oh, he did. Okay, so he did. That's interesting.
He said it very softly, though.
I see. So, actually, Scott Graham, who is our sharp-eared studio tape monitor person, has, in fact, and so apparently, Tim said if he put it on the agenda, he wouldn't vote for it. So, this is the same guy who was going to put on the agenda, who is going to put on the agenda, on the ballot, a law that would make it legal for homeless people to sleep outside. It would strike the word sleeping from the camping ordinance, although he would have added that you couldn't do it in a vehicle. Craziest thing I ever heard. But at least he would have said, people outside, you're not going to arrest if they don't have a vehicle for sleeping on the ground. And then he turned around and he wouldn't even introduce that. He voted against any discussion or introduction of that last summer. So he really is dodging the issue, it seems to me. He's not admitting his own position has changed. Did he discuss that with you any time further in this conversation?
No, he didn't. He didn't discuss any change in position or anything of that sort. What did he discuss after that?
Is there more on this tape that pertains to the sleeping ban? Or?
Yeah.
Let's play a little more, and maybe you can give your thoughts on that. I noticed he didn't answer your question.
No. I asked him 3 times.
Really?
Yeah. I think it was either at least twice or 3 times.
So you asked him again, you know, how many community members does it take for you to believe this is the will of the community? And he said, go put it on the ballot.
Yes.
And now I guess Linda speaks here. Yeah. Do you want to say something?
That's actually the last bit on the sleeping ban itself.
Uh-huh.
She's just wants clarification on what was going on with the ballot measure that he had written.
Uh-huh.
And just why it didn't pass. Because she remembers reading in newspapers that it passed because it had gotten over 50%.
Right, but you need two-thirds.
It needs two-thirds,
right.
Yeah. She was just clarifying that.
And was there is there anything more on this tape that we should...
There's a conversation much later on rent control,
mm-hmm.
which was really interesting. And really, for me, I learned a lot from this conversation, especially from the last two questions that I asked, because that's what really showed me that someone with integrity who comes into a political position, maybe they have their hands tied somehow. Maybe they get caught in this mess of the powerful, because maybe you, I don't know, it put into question what does it mean to be on the city council? What can you do? What can't you do? If you can't do something just because it's politically unsuccessful or you believe it will be, what does that mean?
Well, again, I think we got to be real careful about the words politically unsuccessful. If politically unsuccessful means you'll be voted out, it means a majority of the community doesn't want it, it means you don't have the votes on the council, those are three possibilities.
Right.
That's one thing. But I don't think either of those three conditions adheres. I guess they would argue that, former council member Rotkin used to say, well, you know, if we passed a sleeping ban repeal, we'd be voted out immediately, we'd be recalled.
Right.
I don't think that is true, and I don't know if Fitzmaurice is claiming that, because he doesn't clarify. Certainly he has the votes to pass it. If he chose to favor it, it would pass. Mm-hmm. I think that I don't think he can dispute. So he does. It's not that it's not politically possible to pass it. Certainly it's quite politically possible. That's what Sugar said for years, that he didn't have the votes, and that's why he wouldn't put it on the agenda.
Right.
Fitzmaurice, however, does have the votes, yet he's still claiming it's not politically possible. What's the third thing? That his supporters don't want it, that he won't be elected the next time.
Right.
Maybe he needs to find some new supporters. If a majority of the community wants this passed, then I think he needs to deal with it.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, how you doing, Robert?
I'm good.
This is Bud.
Hey, Bud, have you been listening in?
Just for the few moments, I was watching the football game.
Uh-oh. Well, you gotta listen to our radio show, Bud.
Well, I got it on one ear.
All right. You've been listening. We're talking about the sleeping ban, but I know that you came back into town as a...
Friday night.
...a massive street spirit vendor. Where do you sell street spirit?
Well, I'm on my way to my spot now at the corner of Elms and Pacific Ave, outside the front door of Streetlight Records.
Oh, and you got plenty of street spirits you're ready to sell?
Well, I do need more.
Uh-huh. Well, you know where the Street Spirit Distribution Center is? Over there at Huff headquarters. Again, we're kind of limited on street spirits this month in terms of the number we got, but do what you can with them.
Yeah.
Any impressions of the town since you got back?
Not that I've noticed.
Okay. Anything you want to say about anything you've heard on the radio?
Sure, why not? I think the city council ought to at least do some kind of trial basis about the sleeping ban, because it doesn't seem like they're going to make it legal for the sleeping ban anyway. Because you got to look at it this way: if they pass the sleeping ban, that's going to put a whole lot of people in the downtown district and the community area. They're not going to be for that. It's going to put a lot of problems on it.
Well, you see, that's what we've always said, that that's not going to happen, because what you do
precisely, it's not going to happen, so they're not going to pass that.
Well, no, what I'm saying is, if you pass the repeal of the sleeping ban, a lot of people would not come downtown per se to sleep. I mean, there's no particular reason to do that. They would sleep where they are, perhaps a little more visibly. That's true in different areas, but I don't think it would result in an influx of
people. I think what they should do, mm-hmm. what city council should look at, is just do a temporary trial basis just to see what happens.
That's certainly reasonable.
I mean, that way it can at least be somewhat legal to sleep outside.
Right. Now, you yourself, did you sleep outside last night?
Oh, yeah. I sleep at the same spot, and the people where I camp out, they never had no problems.
Well, then perhaps we don't need to worry about the sleeping ban.
Well, not just saying for me, but others.
I see.
I'm not just speaking for myself, though.
Do you know if others have had problems with that?
Well, one guy that was at the shelter this morning, at the Coral Street shelter, he had a seizure this morning.
Right. Well.
And they had to take him to the hospital.
Right, but how would the sleeping bands being lifted help that?
Good question.
Well, my answer, by the way, to my own question would be that he was lucky to be at the shelter when he had the seizure, because if he'd been hiding in the bushes, he might have gotten no help.
Yeah.
So that if
he busted his, looked like he busted his head wide open because he started bleeding real bad.
Wow. But what I'm saying is, if the sleeping band were lifted, then people could sleep together in groups in well-lighted areas, and they could use the police more easily when these kinds of problems come up. So I think that it would be certainly helpful for people to avoid accidental conditions and beatings if the sleeping band were lifted. That's been my view. What do you think?
That's a good point.
Well, Bud, I thank you for calling in. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, I would like to know if you have any papers you can drop by. I would appreciate it after your program.
Uh-huh. Well, let's see what happens. You know where I am.
Well, I know where you're at now.
Right. Well, you might check me after the show.
Okay.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So we're still in the studio with Chris Congleton. I'm your host, Robert Norris, here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3. Phone lines are open at 427-3772. Chris is a teacher locally who has been particularly interested in the sleeping ban and has gone to Mayor Fitzmaurice. We've just played a bit of Fitzmaurice's conversation, which was recorded with Tim Fitzmaurice's permission, though I don't think necessarily aired with his permission. But, hey, once you allow a tape to be a project, it becomes a project. Tim may have been informed that our show is happening. I requested that, and I'm not sure if that actually happened, but certainly Tim always has an opportunity to reply on the air. We will not attempt to get a restraining order against him at this time. Who knows? Maybe that's the mayor calling in now. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
The mayor has been informed, along with council members Emily Riley and Ed Porter.
Have they been informed directly or by answering machine?
By answering machine.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, thank you.
My, that was a quick response. I want to thank producer Becky Johnson for having her ear to the speaker. It's a particularly difficult time because Becky Johnson is also named on this injunction, along with myself and Bernard Klitzner. So we have to spend literally dozens of hours preparing for this court injunction Wednesday. And again, I invite people to come to this hearing. It's going to be in Department 7 at 701 Ocean Street, the county building. And there's going to be a press conference before the hearing at 8 o'clock on the steps of the county building, where there will be, get this, free pizza. Now, I don't know if you're into free pizza at 8 in the morning, but you won't be hungry if you come to this particular shindig. And again, the council meeting, the city council meets at 3, 5, and 7. 7 is the time when there's this formal oral communications period when you can speak on items not on the agenda, and that, of course, is the sleeping ban, any homeless shelter issue, any decriminalization of homelessness for sitting or for any of the other, you might say, life-sustaining behaviors. You got to sit down or you fall down eventually. And that's illegal, too, downtown, to lie down anywhere downtown. You're not even a matter of sleeping. If you lie down on Pacific Avenue, for example, even off to the side, that's criminal behavior. So the criminals who are running the city council, need to be told by the community that it's time to start striking some of these crazy laws from the books. And that is what we've been doing here today in terms of discussing this issue. Reasonable people who go in and talk to Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice don't seem to get reasonable answers. What do you think? Am I unfairly maligning our mayor here?
No. I was really frustrated with speaking with him in terms of my preconceptions about what our city council is and does and how they function. I no longer feel like they're an adequate outlet for change in this community, even with community support. Tim Fitzmaurice himself suggested a ballot initiative instead of speaking with him. That's really strange to me.
Particularly since he has the majority. We have another caller, I believe. Caller, call back, and we will put you on the line. Here you go.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. Bob here again. I just wanted to ask your guest to paraphrase, if he would, Mayor Fitzmaurice's comments on rent control.
Thank you.
You bet.
So, paraphrase his comments on rent control. Very simply, he said that rent control was something that was important to him, and then he went on to say that it was something that was such a big issue for him to take on that he could not possibly do anything about it until he had a 100% solution that he could suddenly spring out into the world. Because just by being the mayor, he could, if he begins to talk about rent control, suddenly landlords everywhere will start raising their rents in response to this coming rent control crisis that he's been bringing up. And so, basically, he can't do anything about it until he can do everything about it. Which means, to me,
he's not going to do anything about it. Wow. I mean, you know, one can see that this argument has a certain plausibility in a certain way, but the whole idea of operating behind closed doors, and this is what Ed Porter also talked about. Ed Porter's going to be and Arnie Leff, when he was running, he's the chair of the Citizens Police Review Board, also talked about the problems having the Brown Act. I think we may have a response from our questioner here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, I have to call back and comment.
Sure.
And thank you. I mean, my goodness, what is the definition of leadership? My goodness, if you can't move without having every duck in a row, then what are you about? This is shameful. This is beyond cowardice. This is fraud. This is despicable cowardice. Posturing, hypocritical, despicable. It's an effrontery. I'm shocked. I mean, I knew this existed on some level. But to pass off every issue that is provocative and dynamic by saying that, well, the votes aren't there for 100% solution, or we don't want to upset the status quo, that is beyond sloughing off. Mm-hmm. It has to be commented on and publicly.
Yeah.
I think it's a scandal.
It should be.
It's a leadership scandal in this town, and anyone who considers themselves even moderately to be an activist should know, by the way, that SCAN is an absolute joke and a fraud and has been for years.
By the way, the SCAN steering committee is meeting on Wednesday night at their offices, from which I am banned, by the way.
Well, when Bernice Belton and Nora Hockman step down, maybe SCAN might have some legitimacy in it once again.
And for those who are interested, I would encourage people to go to the SCAN steering committee meeting. When we had our housing committee, before they dissolved our committee, in essentially a closed meeting held in a private home, so that we wouldn't further discuss the sleeping ban and the Dolphin Lee project, our housing committee allowed members of the community to come to our committee meetings.
Let me paraphrase Mayor Tempest Morris.
Sure, hang on just a second, though.
Oh, I think you bet.
The steering committee for SCAN, I want to remind people, is meeting at 5:30. I believe it's at 314 Laurel Street, which is the storefront across from Loudon Elson Center and kitty corner from the new police station. And it starts to meet at 5:30, and they discuss issues. We did successfully get SCAN to say, don't evict all the Dolphin Lee tenants, don't take any action to establish a new project until you have guarantees for the tenants that they won't be dumped out on the street. And Sugar and Fitzmaurice, you know, promised 100 ways from Sunday, but then, of course, they're doing just that anyway. So I encourage people to come to that meeting at 5:30, even if you're not a SCAN member, and ask the SCAN steering committee to take some action on that and the sleeping ban issue, which, of course, is a protracted scandal. SCAN has repeatedly said it favors ending the sleeping ban, but it's people they've elected do exactly the opposite.
I was going to paraphrase Mayor Fitzmaurice in this way. I agree with the issue, but I don't want to come forth and take any position on it because it's going to rock the boat.
Yeah,
imagine that's on tape. During the Civil Rights Movement. Well, I agree that the blacks shouldn't be pushed to the back of the bus, but I don't want to rock the boat. So unless there's a 100% solution out there and all the ducks are in a row, well, I'm just going to kick back and wait for the bandwagon.
You know, there's never a 100% solution.
Of course not.
You know,
how brutally, viciously disgusting.
You know, it's not even a matter of you know, getting pissed with Tim Fitzmaurice and saying how stupid he is, because, but I do think that it's obviously the exactly what you say. It's cowardice, it's evasion. But most important, it's futile. It means that there will be no action taken by these politicians until they don't have to take any action other than simply introduce it onto the agenda and slide it through.
It's
so
unbelievably
that being
disgusting.
The case, we have to realize that these people aren't going to do it, and we have to find another avenue to get it done. Maybe that's why he was telling us to go to the ballot, because I'm not going to help you.
That's
not going to help you.
That's the clear message I received.
These are elected officials. They are not leaders.
True enough.
What is leadership? Robert, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right.
Well, I think at a future show, I'd love to find the rent control section and play that on the air, because I think it's really important for people to know just what's going on. And I think that what he tells your group, you know, Tim can always change his mind. Maybe tomorrow he'll come up with rent control on the ballot. Maybe he'll reverse himself on the sleeping ban. I mean, it's happened before with Sugar. He swore 100 ways from Sunday he wouldn't do anything about the sleeping ban until he got everything lined up. And who knows? Maybe then suddenly Catherine Byers came in, gave him a little hope, and then withdrew her help during last May. But I think it's really good to get these statements by public officials, Ed Porter, Emily Riley, Tim Fitzmaurice, out on the air, so we can see just what kind of double talk we're dealing with. And I call it double talk because what he told you is not what he told the electorate in 1998, is not what he told the community in 2000 in the summer when the safe sleeping zones came up. And we have heard no reasonable explanation as to why he's changed his mind. You know, is it John Laird and Marty Wormhout and an inner trust of individuals who said, we are not going to let you raise these issues. If you do, we won't give you our support. He did mention his supporters. Is that right, Chris?
He did mention his supporters.
What did he say about that? That was said rather softly. Maybe you can tell us what that was.
I believe he simply mentioned that, you know, he had lost a lot of his support from his actions in June, from supporting what was going on. He had lost support, and he communicated that he felt like he would lose a lot more support if he did anything about the sleeping ban.
I'm sure that he's being quite honest there, and but I suspect he would get support from other quarters, and I suspect that in carrying through an issue and resolving an issue, he would not only perhaps be getting more support, but he would also be addressing a long, and this is just as a political issue, addressing a long festering sore that is going to, it's not going to go away. You know, and he can blame me and the activists all he wants. He can concoct restraining orders galore, but people are continuing to die outside. We have the largest death toll last year that we ever had, at least in terms of the numbers of people counted. And his credibility continues to drop when he doesn't deal with the issue, when he doesn't follow up on the Homeless Issues Task Force's $10,000 report, on the findings of the committee to examine the camping ordinance the year before, which found there was no magnet effect. When he doesn't respond to the Community Action Board, the Commissioner for the Prevention of Violence Against Women's urgent recommendations that the sleeping ban be overturned to protect women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anyway, we have to keep saying this, and this is what we have to say, of course, to the community, and not so much to him, because he obviously isn't listening. But if the community listens, then maybe we will have a tent city at City Hall raising the issue. Maybe we will have people coming to City Council meeting on Tuesday, 7 o'clock, which is when you have your oral communications time, or come at 3 and talk about other issues, for example, World Religion Day, which I'm now going to talk about. Chris, I appreciate your coming. I wonder if I can borrow this.
Yes.
I'm going to borrow this tape and make a transcription of it so we can actually have it available on Thursday, Bathrop Spears Broadsides, which is the show you're listening to on Free Radio Santa Cruz here at 96.3 FM.
And on Wednesday morning, I guess I'll be having pizza for breakfast.
Pizza for breakfast, and who knows? Mm-hmm. Maybe jail for lunch. No, I'm sure they wouldn't jail the supporters of this.
In front of the county building.
In front of the county building, 701 Ocean Street. It's Department 7. There's also a man going to trial on a sleeping ban ticket at the same time that we're going into court. So if you get bored with us, you can go check him out. This is a 3-year-old vehicular ticket for his sleeping in his vehicle. He's a vet. He says he's not going to plead guilty. He's not going to pay a fine. He's not going to do community service. He has a right to sleep at night. This is the same argument used by Dennis. Having trouble remembering Dennis's last name. Several years ago, he went to court 13 times. He actually won a stay each time they tried to jail him for not paying the fine. He was able to argue against it. So all that's happening on Wednesday, and I'll be looking forward to seeing you there, Chris.
Yeah, I'll be there to support you.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for joining the City Council Coffee Clatch. Maybe you, too, can be on the injunction. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
That's Dennis Rehm.
Dennis Rehm. Thank you very much.
It's like having a research librarian at your fingertips. Dennis Rehm, indeed, is the individual. He, unfortunately, ran the deadline. His volunteer attorney missed his deadline. That was Peter Leeming. And that's too bad. We've asked Peter to try to take another case, but we haven't heard from him in the last year, and we're hoping we will, because Peter's done some good work. He defended Sandy Loringer, the woman accused of serving free food. Can you imagine that? Who actually spent a month or, well, 3 weeks in jail in the Santa Cruz County Jail in 1989 for serving food to homeless people. Not unhealthy food, but food. That was because of Marty Wormhout's plan to drive homeless people away from public spaces and to eliminate the free food giveaway. That's our supervisor, Marty Wormhout, the great liberal progressive. So, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Robert Norris, and we are going to return now. Well, I was going to return to the Citizens Police Review Board complaint report, and the problem is there really is quite a number of complaints to go through, and I want people to be able to hear that at a time when they can really get the full story. This is the complaints against the police department for their abusive actions of May 22nd, 1999, which David Lefebvre has left the force. I don't have evidence specifically in a smoking gun that says that he was told to leave, although that's the scuttlebutt, and it seems that the complaints that were sustained, I'll just read these briefly. Sustained complaint, failure to make adequate announcements and warnings. There was a sustained complaint against Officer Lefebvre that he used excessive force against the woman with the child. There was a sustained complaint that excessive force was used in the arrest of Steve Argue, and that was against David Lefebvre. Although it's interesting, his name is not here. But that was sustained 4-3. And the other sustained complaint was sustained 5-2. So there's a significant minority that isn't going to sustain any complaints, even after a long investigation on the Citizens Police Review Board. There was a complaint that there was inappropriate use of mace, and it's actually not mace, it's pepper spray, as far as I know. Why they're calling mace pepper spray in this, I don't know. They say mace in one paragraph, they say pepper spray in the next. That's your Citizens Police Review Board. And this, again, was 4-3. The board found the pepper spray was used at too close a distance. Proper warning was not given prior to its use, that other forms of compliance should have been used when the spray initially failed to gain compliance. This is when they stuck pepper spray down Steve Argue's throat. It's a little mild for what they did, actually. A little mild. And they should have, of course, immediately schedule hearings to research, investigate, and put pressure on the police department to change this policy. And then that is it. So they sustained 3 of the 20, what is it, 4, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. 4 out of 22 complaints, 3 out of 22 complaints were sustained. Am I got that right? 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 out of 22 were sustained. $10,000 later, a year and a half later, confidential report. We don't get to know why, but 4 out of 22 were sustained. So, that's our police review board. That's our police department. That's our city council, which should have investigated this issue long ago or made sure that a real public investigation got held, and they did not. I have a... As I shuffle with my papers here, I hope I have this stuff with me. I think I do. I'm looking for some really great correspondence between Becky Johnson, that's the little voice in the background that gives me all the factual information that you heard calling in several times, and also she was corresponding with a rabbi in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm going to read the story that the rabbi, actually, I guess, drew the rabbi, her attention to rabbi. The rabbi, his name is Rabbi Chaim Levin in the first place. And then the correspondence that he had with her and with the mayor of Santa Cruz, Tim Fitzmaurice. This is from the Baltimore Jewish Times, December 22nd. A crowd of approximately 100 activists and homeless people assembled in front of City Hall, Baltimore, Maryland, on Monday, December 18th, braving the bone-chilling 23-degree air. Every day, twice a day, for the last 2.5 years, members of the Environmental Crises Center, the nonprofit homeless advocacy group, and other organizations have been meeting in this exact location to distribute meals to the homeless. Monday's larger assembly had gathered to protest an official request from the office of the mayor to move the operation to another location. According to police, use of the alternative site across from the state's prison complex at the corner of Falls Way and East Madison Street should have commenced on December 4th, but the organizations refused to comply and continue to feed needy people at City Hall. The December 18th protest was organized after police handcuffed participants in last week's food distribution. No arrests were made. Rabbi Chaim Levin, a Lubavitcher teacher at the tomb of Samuel the prophet Kollel in Jerusalem, has worked with the ECC, that's the Environmental Crises Center, for the past 3 months. The Chicago native said he feels obligated to advocate on behalf of the homeless. This is a Jewish story, said Rabbi Levin. The Torah tells us that God created the world for the Jews, so therefore everything that is wrong in the world is also a Jew's responsibility. Rabbi Levin joined arms with ECC Director Charles Swindon as the crowd linked hands to form a circle. Mr. Swindon, a self-described born-again Christian, offered a hopeful prayer for understanding and a peaceful resolution to the impasse before the food was distributed. Soon after, as the hot chili, hot dogs, cupcakes, and fruit were doled out to the 30 to 40 homeless recipients, Rabbi Levin pointed out an absurd observation that compounded his frustration with the mayor's request. Two blocks south of the contentious City Hall Square is a well-known spot commonly called the Block. The gaudy locale sports brightly lit marquees and pornographic entertainment. So down the street is this X-rated block. I didn't know it was there, and I had to cover my eyes, exclaimed Rabbi Levin. Businesses on the block are protected, but here, feeding the poor, this we need to hide from the public eye. Mr. Swindon contends that feeding the poor in front of City Hall is not only a handy, accessible, and practical place to reach a lot of people with needs, but serves to make a social comment as well. We have the right to assemble and the right to bring our grievances to City Hall, said Mr. Swindon. This problem shouldn't be swept under the rug or shoved under a bridge. The ECC also provides services and resources for homeless and poverty-stricken people and has recently initiated a new program called the Homestead Project, where the group repairs donated houses and places previously homeless people in them. The group feeds between 100 to 150 people daily. In his time here in Baltimore, Rabbi Levin has been counseling at the center and doing a lot of cooking. Working at the center is not political, the rabbi said, but it is the work that God wants him to do. We are all homeless until Messiah comes, said Rabbi Levin. We are all in exile, trying to get back to the Garden of Eden. Although the group anticipated arrests, Monday's gathering attracted little attention. Police walked quietly around the square, but no attempts were made to stop the food distribution. At press time, Mayor Martin O'Malley announced a commitment to provide shelters and services for the city's homeless around the area, scheduled to open by spring 2001. In the meantime, Rabbi Levin hopes the mayor will allow the organizations to continue their work in peace. What the Torah tells us is that Jews are not allowed to turn anyone away in need. We don't want to fight with the mayor. We will pray for him. This again is from the Baltimore Jewish Times of December 22nd. Rabbi helps fight for the homeless. It talks about Rabbi Chaim Levin in Baltimore, Maryland. Well, my ever-active producer got a wind of this and sent a letter to the Rabbi Levin, which read, I just wanted to congratulate you on your successful effort to lobby the Baltimore City Council to provide more funding for homeless people. This is a letter that Becky wrote on December 30th, so apparently between the 22nd and the 30th, Rabbi was able to get some funding. Maybe she can actually let us know more about that if she can, although we're running short on time, and I'm going to hustle with this. I'm a member of HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, which has been engaged in a 17-day protest here in Santa Cruz since December 4th regarding our sleeping and blanket bans. These are laws long on the books which criminalize the act of sleeping and of covering up with blankets from 11 p.m. to 8:30 a.m. each day. Santa Cruz has an estimated homeless population of 1,500 and shelter space in winter only for about 160. 45 homeless people have died in the past year. To effect a change, we've been engaged in a peaceful sit-in in Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice's office to urge him to schedule repeal of the sleeping and blanket bans on the city council agenda. On December 27th, I and two others were served with a temporary restraining order alleging harassment of a female employee of the city. We believe it is the mayor who orchestrated the suit, which our attorney believes to be a slap suit, a strategic lawsuit against public participation. Since in 17 days none of us received so much as a citation, the lawsuit necessarily fabricated and distorted incidents that had occurred in order to smear us and to muddy the issue we are protesting. Meanwhile, our homeless are cold, tired, harassed by the police around the clock, and dying. Our issue is that making a homeless person a criminal for the necessary acts of sleeping and protecting from hypothermia only further deepens their suffering and reduces their chances of ending their homelessness. Ironically, city officials have told us that the sleeping ban is necessary to keep property values up in a city where the price of housing is pouring more and more people onto the street. I was greatly encouraged by your success and your courage of continuing to feed people at City Hall despite the pressure to stop. If you would, could you send a letter of support for our struggle against the sleeping ban? Address it to Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice and the Santa Cruz City Council. Homelessness is a solvable human problem. I am proud to be in this struggle with people like you. Thank you for your good work, and thank you in advance for supporting our work. Well, Reverend Chaim Levin of Baltimore, Maryland, did respond, and he wrote to the mayor this letter. All religious and spiritual traditions don't amount to much if they can't teach us to open our hearts to the poor. The next time you feel hassled by a homeless person, ask yourself why a society that can spend hundreds of billions on weapons won't provide food and housing to the least amongst us. Our society has the resources to feed and house every homeless person without raising any of your taxes. It's just a matter of our priorities, where we want to allocate our money. The great spiritual and religious traditions of the human race have insisted that a high priority must be given to caring for the poor, but in late 20th century America, the ethos of selfishness and materialism has become the common sense of society. Every day, our economic institutions teach us to look out for number one and to assume that if we care for others, we will somehow hurt our own interests. These values are so deeply ingrained in what is called rationality in our society that people fear they will be seen as utopian nutcases if they take seriously the fundamental spiritual and religious values that are the collective heritage of the human race. Indeed, the greatest irony is to see people who claim to be religious actually advocating that we turn our backs on the plight of others. Some people are philosophically opposed to the government being the instrument of social caring. They argue that this should be left to individual initiative. We would respect this argument more if each person who felt that way came into our city each evening and brought home a homeless person for the night. That kind of individual act of loving kindness still has an important place, but if you don't do that and you claim to share spiritual or religious values, you have an obligation to be engaged in communal acts of caring, either by actively engaging in homeless support within a religious community or through active political support for the expansion of government housing and food for the homeless today. Institutions are judged rational or efficient to the extent to which they create lots of wealth or power. We want to extend the definition so institutions or social practices are also judged efficient, caring, or productive to the extent to which they help us to become loving people who are ethically, spiritually, and ecologically sensitive. We call this a politics of meaning. This is part of the message of our religious tradition. We urge you to join with us not only in fighting for the homeless, but in the larger struggle to change the bottom line in our society. And as we do that, we need to engage in thousands of little acts of love and caring in our own lives. Working on both fronts at the same time, changing ourselves and changing our society, is the best way to live the values of our religious and spiritual traditions teach us, from strength to strength and heart to heart, Rabbi Chaim Levin. That's his letter to Tim Fitzmaurice. Now, this is Tim's letter in response. Our mayor wrote back on January 4th to Rabbi Levin, "Thank you for your letter about changing the bottom line on homelessness. I guess you've been contacted by activists in our community to support their protest in our offices. I can tell you that the effort to help the homeless in our town is not being neglected. We just received a $2.5 million grant to help with transitional housing for single people for 10 years. Getting that grant, 10 times more than last year, was an effort of this city's administration. We have just built a new kitchen to feed millions of meals meals with $500,000 of our city funds. I just got the shelter hours extended every morning for an hour to make the place more humane. I spent most of my time today on the issues of homeless people as a group and as individuals. I am trying to do something real. The protest by three or four people has not even attracted the local homeless community's support, but it is a complex matter. I appreciate your comments nonetheless. It does require hard and practical effort to make a change. Signed, Tim Fitzmaurice. Now, the rabbi sent this letter back to Becky Johnson, who replied and gave her thoughts in response to Tim Fitzmaurice's letter. In response to Fitzmaurice is saying, thank you for your letter about changing the bottom line on homelessness. I guess you've been contacted by activists in our community to support their protest in our offices. I can tell you the effort to help the homeless in our town is not being neglected. Becky replies, for the past 10 years, Santa Cruz has spent about $1.5 million on homeless services. The bulk of that was paid for by grants from the state and the feds. For instance, Page Smith Community House provides transitional housing and counseling for 40 single adults at a cost of over $3 million to build. Yet services fall far short of the need, which has been increasing at an alarming rate. No new shelter has come online in Santa Cruz since July of 98. Mayor Fitzmaurice writes, we just received a $2.5 million grant to help with transitional housing for single people for 10 years. Getting that grant, 10 times more than last year, was an effort of the city administration. Becky Johnson replies, it was the county of Santa Cruz that got the grant, not the city, but it is very welcome. From what I understand, and I am still researching this, lobbying at the national level was done for HUD to kick down some serious money for homeless services after years of neglect. No doubt the city put together paperwork suggesting nonprofits to funnel the funding to, but for Mayor Fitzmaurice to claim any credit for this is really a stretch. One of the recipients, Mercy Charities Housing, Inc., Huff has been very critical of because a recent project which uses up 5 years of funding for affordable housing from the redevelopment agency will actually destroy more housing than it creates. Tim Fitzmaurice, who is a Catholic, is a huge and uncritical supporter of Mercy Charities Housing, a Catholic organization. We have just built a new kitchen to feed millions of meals with $500,000 of our city funds, writes Tim Fitzmaurice. Becky Johnson replies, the Homeless Services Center kitchen was a welcome addition and badly needed for the past 8 years. 100 to 200 people a day were fed out of a little trailer. The dining hall for years was a slightly remodeled car garage and very dark and dingy. The food quality has improved slightly in the past year, at least at the 4 p.m. meal. Breakfast at 8 a.m. to 8:30 a.m. when the door is then promptly locked and absolutely no seconds remains a nutritional nightmare. Perhaps with the new refrigerated storage area, the food quality will now improve. But with the kitchen project, as usual, the project money all went to builders and developers. Most funds are spent on middle-class service providers, offices, and equipment, such as buses, to cart people to and from the shelters. Little trickles down to actual homeless people. Fitzmaurice writes, I just got the shelter hours extended every morning for an hour to make the place more humane. Becky Johnson replies, the armory is not humane. People must sign up at one location between 3 and 3:30 p.m. and wait for up to 3 hours until buses come to take them to the remotely located National Guard Armory to sleep. Previously at 5 a.m., people were, I'm told, rudely awakened, hustled out of the building to wait outside for up to 2 hours waiting for the bus back to the Homeless Services Center. So to spend a single It is true that Tim Fitzmaurice did lobby the state to allow people to sleep in until 6 a.m. This was done twice in the past 4 years by two other mayors. Each time, after extensive lobbying between the National Guard authorities and the Homeless Services Center, they did agree to let people sleep in that 1 hour. Yet each year, the National Guard has moved the time back to 5 a.m. at the beginning of a new contract. This insane little dance done between bureaucrats and National Guard officials illustrates the glacial pace anything positive for the homeless getting done around here. Mayor Fitzmaurice and the rest of the council, for that matter, are really willing to flaunt a cosmetic image of how kind they are for homeless people when they could care less if there is any substance to it. Ask Tim why he doesn't relocate the shelter to a city building where it doesn't require 5 months of negotiating to change the schedule by 1 hour. Ask Tim where people with jobs until 5 p.m., unaccompanied minors, people with dogs, people who are currently using alcohol or drugs, people who have been put out, people who chose to sleep in their vehicles, people who have compromised immune systems, couples who wish to sleep together, and women with children who are terrified CPS will seize their children if they use the shelter. Where will all these sleep at night? On the plus side, the armory is warm and clean, and the mattresses were recently upgraded. The shelter occupancy was also downsized from 200 to 100 as considered full, greatly alleviating crowding. Asked him why he thinks he has the moral right to condemn homeless people who are not in the shelter to walk the streets awake each night from 11 to 8:30 a.m. without using a blanket. And without sleeping, I might add. The law is inhumane. Why does he support a law which criminalizes the act of sleeping and of covering up with blankets? And that is Becky Johnson's letter in response to Tim Fitzmaurice's letter to Rabbi Chaim Levin, the man who was not afraid to serve homeless people food in front of City Hall in Baltimore, even at the risk of arrest. And I will commend myself for doing the same. I did that in San Francisco repeatedly with Food Not Bombs, and we did that in, well, for it took about 8 years, and then they arrested hundreds of us. They convicted me. I served a month in jail, and as a consequence of this endless protest, and this is one of the positive results of protest, they aren't arresting Food Not Bombs people for serving food anymore. And you can get a meal up there, and you can also get a meal from Food Not Bombs, I guess, on the 2 or 3 days a week that they serve here. Food Not Bombs, by the way, for those who want to volunteer for them or get more information about them, is 425-3345, 425-3345. Whoa. Well, this is still Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I'm still looking for a musical tape to play. And hopefully we'll get one. But our time is almost up. I want to thank everybody who did call in for your calls and to let you know that we all will be coming back on Thursday from 6 to 8 in the evening. I'm going to be spending the rest of my day struggling with declarations, transcriptions of the many hours of tape, video, audio tape, that those of us who are at the City Council Coffee Clutch had to make because Mayor Fitzmaurice began harassing That's Mayor Fitzmaurice personally, began harassing members of the protest, demanding they leave the offices, grilling them, speaking to them in a threatening tone of voice. And we have some of this on tape, and we're hoping that Judge Samuel Stevens on Wednesday morning at 8:30 in Department 7 will respond to this transparent attempt to end a political protest by couching it as some sort of a stalking or harassment of staff episode. It's... Who knows? It's hard to tell what will happen. But I think we are out of here. And a little red hen should be arriving even as I speak. And she's right on time here. No more waiting outside in the cold. So, hey, I'm going to turn this mic over to these fine chickens and see if they can... peck a little butt, so to speak. Thanks again for being with me. Again, City Council, in case you're interested, 420-5017 is the number to call in. Tell them end the sleeping ban, end the injunction. Here we have a quick phone call here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hello, Mr. Panda Bear. Aileen Smith.
Hey, Aileen.
Also known as Quatora Cummings.
Okay.
Great show.
Hey, thank you. Anything you want to say to the community before we leave?
Well, I don't have it in front of me, darn. I wish I'd tuned in earlier.
Okay,
and I'll drop it off to you, and you can give it on your next radio station.
Okay.
The commentaries I had in the newspapers, did you see them?
I haven't seen them yet.
Well, I'll drop the copies over to you.
Sounds good.
All right, over and out.
Bye-bye.
Fat and docile, big and dumb. They look so stupid, they aren't much fun. Cows aren't fun. They eat to grow, grow to die, die to be ate at the hamburger fry. Cows well done. Nobody thunk it, nobody knew. No one imagined the great cow guru. Cows are one. He hid in the forest, read books with great zeal. He loved Che Guevara, a revolutionary veal. Cows say tongue. He spoke about justice, but nobody stirred. He felt like an outcast, alone in the herd.
cowed all drums. He moved, we must fight, escape or we'll die. Cows gathered around, cause the stakes were so high. Bad cow pun. But then he was captured, stuffed into a crate, loaded onto a truck where he rode to his fate. Cows are bummed. He was a scrawny calf who looked rather woozy. No one suspected he was packing an Uzi. Cows with guns. They came with a needle to stick in his thigh. He kicked for the groin. He pissed in their eye. Cow well hung. Knocked over a tractor and ran for the door. 6 gallons of gas flowed out on the floor. Run, cows, run. He picked up a bullhorn and jumped up on the hay. We are free-roving bovines. We run free today. We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns. Crashed the gate in a great stampede, tipped over milk truck, torched all the feed. Cows have fun. 60 police cars were piled in a heap, covered in cow pies, covered up deep. Much cow dung. Black smoke rising, darkened in the day, 12 burning McDonald's. Have it your way. We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo or die. Cows with guns. The president said, enough is enough. These uppity cattle, it's time to get tough. Cow dung flung. The newspapers gloated, folks sighed with relief. Tomorrow at noon, they would all be ground beef. Cows on buns. The cows were surrounded, they waited and prayed. They mooed their last moos, they chewed their last hay. Cows outgunned. The order was given to turn cows to whoppers, enforced by the might of 10,000 coppers. But on the horizon, surrounding the shoppers, came the deafening roar of chickens in choppers. We will fight for bovine freedom and hold our large heads high. We will run free with the buffalo. Cows with guns.
But when you use, when you twist the law and you use the police, I guess it accomplishes a similar
temporary cancellation of the sleeping ban for the winter as an emergency measure.
But when you use, when you twist the law and you use the police, I guess it accomplishes a similar kind of repression and fear and a lack of democratic process. I mean, I've never been terribly happy with the lack of democratic process generally that happens in Santa Cruz. You don't have a way for citizens to put items on the agenda. You know, long festering sores like the sleeping ban and rent control are just endlessly sidelined and ducked and dodged and lied about, and then the council members get on. The candidates become council members, and then you don't hear anything more from them on the subject. Then suddenly Emily Riley has to study the issue. Then suddenly Ed Porter wants endless decorum before he's going to do anything. You know, then suddenly Scott Kennedy is, he's going to talk about it for, you know, let's talk, but no action. And, of course, Mark Premack attacks the entire liberal, so-called liberal progressive majority, but he hasn't got a solution either. And the solution is very simple around these two issues. Around the Dolphin Lee, you have a real public process that involves the community there. You open up the process to the entire community, and you figure out what would be the best way to create a low-income housing project that serves a lot of people and that doesn't destroy existing housing. It's not a very difficult, you know, way to format it. And you do so in a series of open meetings that aren't held behind closed doors. You don't have the mayor and the vice mayor shutting down city council mandated relocation advisory committee meetings as they did this summer. They didn't like what the relocation advisory committee, which had a tenant majority, came back and told them, so they shut it down. They eliminated it. All this, incidentally, is kind of going to be touched on in my hearing on Wednesday, even though we're not talking about Dolphin Lee, which is, we're talking about the sleeping ban, but we're also talking about the mayors and the and council member Sugar, who was previously Mayor Fitzmaurice, and former Mayor Sugar's and the council's acquiescence in a series of illegal measures designed to stifle criticism and target activist critics. That's what's going on in Santa Cruz. Now, I suppose it's nothing new, as I said, but the paper trail is getting so long and so massive that hopefully we'll get some kind of response somewhere, somehow, and that's what the last caller, I think, was suggesting. Again, I want to remind you, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and this is your station. 427-3772 is the call-in. And a couple of quick announcements. December 2000, I guess that's still true. Bill Clinton is considering a presidential pardon for Leonard Peltier. Call the White House comments line now, 202-456-1111. Hit zero. Tell our president to free this innocent man before he leaves office in January. In 1985, the FBI admitted, "We don't know who shot the agents. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." So said Martin Luther King Jr. before they shot him down. And again, phone number 202-456-1111, and you hit zero. City council number, in case you don't want to do any of that long-distance calling and pay those charges, is 420-5017. Tell them to A, end the sleeping ban, B, drop the injunction against the activists, and C, establish some real democratic process at city council instead of this sham process whereby a small oligarchy controls the entire process, where John Laird and Marty Wormout seem to have more say about homeless issues here than the homeless service providers. It's just grotesque. Laird is a worker in the Emmeline Street complex. Marty Wormout, of course, is supervisor for this district. And they have, according to what I hear, and I believe it's pretty authoritative, they are the ones who pressured buyers, put the kibosh on any change in the sleeping ban for this summer, and still this kind of Democratic Party hack centrist pressure is coming down not to make any changes or take any actions that might antagonize the powers that be. Well, this is the kind of stuff we have always had to fight about, whether it's, you know, people who are fighting for their rights because of the color of their skin, because of the kind of sexual organs they were born with, reproductive organs they were born with, because of the economic status they're in. All these concerns are still with us, and the sleeping ban is a key and prime economic concern here. And people who are in houses have to worry about it too, because you don't know how long you're going to be able to keep your place. And then when you're out, it's a $54 fine every night. Sorry, that is criminal behavior by the authorities on behalf of a small elite that wants to maintain services and basic survival rights for the few and not for the many. And that's something the many have to respond to. What's your response? Give me a call, 427-3772. I have Emily Riley's response to the Green Party here. And they asked her, would you, if elected, move to remove the sleeping and blanket section of the city's camping ordinance, wherein sleeping or covering up with a blanket are in and of themselves crimes? And Emily, in a written response, said the following, or perhaps this is a transliteration of a speech. Let me see. In any case, it's either written or spoken, but it is typed out. And it goes as follows. I hate the wording of that ordinance. When I read it, I want to wrap myself up in a blanket and march them all. But as a council member, I would not do that. The council has to work together on this issue. Yes, I would urge the council to change that wording. I have heard no such urging from Emily Riley. In fact, she has not repeated that statement in a public forum anywhere that I'm aware of. And perhaps my producer, if she wants to, can get Emily Riley on the phone and ask her if she does, in fact, favor changing that wording and is willing to go public on the radio. And if she's not, well, then I think we have to say that she's probably not. Even though my program here is a controversial one, and no doubt council members might get flack for calling this show, hey, as long as they want to correct misinformation I'm giving out or set the record straight, these airwaves are a place to do it, because there are numerous people listening, and it is a public forum. So, Emily Riley, let's continue hearing your answer to the Greens when asked, would you move to remove the sleeping and blanket sections of the city's camping ordinance? She said, however, I cannot promise I would march into chambers upon election and make a motion to remove those clauses that night. In fact, she said she wouldn't, and in fact, she said she wouldn't do so at the second meeting, and there's no indication she's doing so at the meeting on Tuesday or has any intention of ever doing so. So these are misleading statements by her. She didn't say, I won't do it. I'm a fan of David Silva and respect his vision. Working recently with David and others to establish safe sleeping zones in the city, I was shown in no uncertain terms that if we are going to change any aspect of the camping ban, in even a small and seemingly innocuous way, we must prepare. We need to plan so that we're not just responding to rhetoric with rhetoric. No, it's not rhetoric, Emily, to strike sleeping as a definition of camping. That's not rhetoric. That's substance. But that seems to be what this current city council and the last few city councils have been afraid of. Continuing with Riley's response, I hope we have a council dedicated to improving the lives of homeless people, not just making it okay for them to sleep outside as if that solves the problem. Again, this is a complete diversion. This is the kind of thing that Councilmember Jane Yokoyama said back in 1988 when she had won and was running, that sleeping outside is not good enough for homeless people, therefore let's keep arresting them for sleeping outside until we have affordable housing. It's a completely illogical position, but of course one that's designed to, again, divert attention from that criminal behavior by our government, which now Emily Riley is culpable of and is part of that entire irresponsible group, I've got to say. I hope we have a council dedicated to improving the lives of homeless people, not just making it okay for them to sleep outside as if that solves the problem. I want to focus on solutions for our local homeless citizens, providing education, job training, and building a family shelter. Of course, no shelter over the winter, Emily. I didn't see you ask anything there. Didn't see you follow up on Michael Hernandez's proposal to purchase a building, to open a campground, to open a parking lot, to do anything this winter while we had the highest death toll in Santa Cruz history. 37, the coroner said, 41, the homeless services center, 45 was the figure a few days later, according to less formal sources. But Emily Riley is waiting to get a togetherness aspect to the city council. We can call this, if we're generous, naivete, and perhaps that's what it is. But Riley has been around for 2 years on this issue. She's been to countless meetings. She was chosen by Sugar as part of the select committee to set up the safe zones, a committee from which I was barred, a committee from which all other activists except David Silva were eventually barred. So she was there. She saw the situation. She has been sitting in city council meeting. To her credit, she's come to city council meetings quite regularly. And she actually made her way to a homeless working group meeting finally after the election. And after we repeatedly asked her, she agreed and did come and talk to us for about an hour. And in essence, she was kind of telling us, no, 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 I won't do anything about the sleeping ban because I'm a newbie here, you know, and I don't want to repeat the political mistakes of last summer. This has become the great litany and line. I'm not sure if it's the Laird line or maybe Fitzmaurice has picked it up as his own. And I don't know. I've never heard John Laird say any of this stuff publicly. And I know that Marty Wormhout has killed any support for ending the sleeping ban when we brought it up 2 years ago at her misnamed Winter Emergency Shelter Committee among the supervisors. I know she has derailed any attempt to get action from the very shocking figures of the Needs Assessment 2000 that United Way did last year, which showed huge numbers of homeless people, almost a tripling, according to writer Becky Johnson. And these people, I'm also told, who attend all the rallies and all the fundraisings of the SCAN-endorsed candidates, essentially squeeze the candidates, even like Scott Bugenthal, presumably Ed Porter as well, into backing down from any kind of clear statement, I will strike sleeping from this if I'm elected. We'll find another way to do it. And so now the whole issue has, of course, become a pariah issue. After the safe sleeping zones were shot down this summer by buyers responding to Plantronics and Texas Instruments, who are the large businesses in the industrial zones, their unfounded and bigoted criticism that wasn't based on any documentation, the false media reports being spread by Mike Rotkin, the bogus police maneuvers that herded homeless people into these zones before they were legal, the endless stalling by Mayor Sugar and his committee so that there was no porta-potties and dumpsters put in. The whole thing, of course, then collapsed when buyers ran the other way. It almost seems as though we're an orchestrated collapse because buyers, if the fact that she said no to this gave it a 4-3 defeat majority, but the fact that three people who were continuing on the council said, yes, we want the safe sleeping zones, meant that they could have campaigned for this during the election. They could have said, we want one vote that will let us put this in, and they would have gotten one. In fact, they got two votes. They got Riley and Porter. Porter told me directly after he was elected, what do we do about the sleeping ban? End it, he said. Maybe he was talking about the sleeping ban in China or the sleeping ban in some other city. I'm not sure what he was talking about. But I think we see this deterioration, this irresponsibility that these politicians now have now that they are in office. It's nothing new, but it's something that the community has to contend with. Again, reading more from Emily Riley's statement, we must find a way to eliminate the long wait for alcohol and drug treatment. We didn't arrive at this crisis overnight, and we aren't going to solve it overnight. So everybody can go to sleep, except the homeless, of course, will get tickets. And harassment, beatings, midnight wake-ups, accidental deaths. We need elected officials who will commit to the long haul and who will continue to fund homeless services, look for ways to expand them, and help people who are on the streets now to find shelter without punishing them for being without it. My concern for this issue is also why I support Measure U on the November ballot, which will provide additional funds for homeless services. And that, of course, is a whole another barrel of trouble, or it's a situation where a badly drafted resolution, Measure U, which would have increased the TOT, transient occupancy tax, and then put the money into shelter, failed because the businesses were drawn in late, and it also didn't guarantee that existing funding would continue from the general fund, so they could have for funding that was being put in by this new measure and essentially use the money for other things. That is, the Measure U money would have had to go for shelter, but they could have simply reduced general funding for current shelter projects. And so they would have, in essence, had people vote for one thing and get another. And you might call this incompetence by the city attorney and Tim Fitzmaurice and the others who put this thing together, or you can call it another slick deal where they wanted more flexibility, or you can call it simply an election eve deal to kind of get the liberals together because they weren't willing to stand up on the sleeping ban. In any case, after the election, they had a chance to immediately move to simply put aside a portion of the general funding for shelter. That council can do that by a majority. That hasn't been done. It isn't even being discussed. It's not on the agenda. This so-called concern with shelter by Emily Riley and others doesn't stand up to close scrutiny. If you don't act on the issue, you're not concerned about it, particularly in the middle of a crisis where more people are dying than ever before. Ed Porter was also asked these questions. Here's a man who supposedly And he's very forthright, told the Green Party this. The Miami court decision says it very clearly. It's a human right to sleep. Our law is in conflict with basic human rights, but that's not obvious to a lot of people in the city. We have a lot of people who are not sympathetic to that court decision. So the question is, what's doable politically? I would change the law. There's no question about that. The law of the city. Along with that comes the opportunity of the TOT tax that would provide funding to build places for people to sleep. There absolutely has to be a place. The armory is not enough. There must be other facilities. No reason we can't have places for vehicles to go, except that he doesn't want to say a thing about it. That's, I guess, one good reason that we haven't got places for vehicles to go. My interjection. Continuing with Ed Porter, talking to the Green Party. I've advocated use of the county parking lot, but no political support. We could have a couple of acres at Wilder Ranch. I would pursue it. I don't understand why we're preserving 100% of that property yet not providing for the needs of the homeless. Homeless without vehicles. In our arcane housing laws, we require that rooms be 400, 800 square feet before they're legal to sleep in. But homeless people don't need more than a mattress and a respectable place where they're safe, e.g. a camper shell that is smaller than those official dimensions. We can build things like that and put some facilities in place for daily laundry. Everybody should support the TOT tax so we have the money to provide these various solutions. It provides our best hope in 30 years. So, has Ed called up activists? Has he come to homeless working group meetings we've invited him to? Has he even stopped to talk to us during the 3 weeks that we sat in these offices? He hasn't returned one phone call. Now, that may be because Ed doesn't want to offend his other council members, most notably Tim Fitzmaurice, who apparently is just having conniption fits that we were in the offices waiting there, and, of course, continued to rant at us that we were harassing the women. Completely false charge, which hopefully will be tossed out. We weren't even charged with it. We weren't charged with any crime. They just used that to get a civil restraining order. You need a lesser standard of proof. Apparently you don't need any proof because we weren't given a chance to respond. But we will, of course, on Wednesday. We have an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert.
Hey, how you doing, Bernard?
Well, you know, one correction there. Ed Porter, the few days that I was out,
uh-huh.
You know, when I was in L.A., he did leave a phone message, you know, wanting to talk to me. However, you know, he said he would call again, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he hasn't called back.
Okay. Well, I know that Ed, I've left him repeated messages. He's been endlessly invited to homeless working group meetings, and he hasn't so far responded. And I know he promised that he would call me when I talked to him on November 28th at the new city council member seating at the end of the week. And, of course, it's now a month, more than a month later.
Are you still waiting?
I'm waiting breathlessly by the phone. Maybe you can call Ed and get him to call into the show. What do you think?
Well, do you know his number offhand?
You know, I don't. I think it's actually listed. If people, by the way, want the city council members' numbers today, they can either call the hotline at 420-5017, or you can contact the Huff line, 423-HUFF, and I think there may be somebody at that line now. And ask that person to give you the city council member's home number, which is, they printed their home numbers in their election literature, and I believe we still have them. Now, they may have changed their phone numbers now that they've won, but maybe not. So
I don't think Ed has, but I don't have.
Well, call up Ed and tell him that, you know, here's a chance to have a forum. Here's a chance to respond to concerns and criticisms. As far as I'm concerned, he's done nothing. And I know that he made a proposal for a double-wide trailer, talking to Michael Schmidt about that and discussing the idea of housing, I don't know, 10 or 15 people instead of dealing with any significant expansion of shelter like a campground or decriminalizing the people who are outside. And I'm not impressed. I'm not going to give him points for that, and particularly when he doesn't go public with this issue, because that's his key power, I think.
And you wonder where the Green Party is sitting.
Well, I thought they had a meeting actually yesterday or today. That's what I heard from David Silva. But
what are they
doing? You know, they should be at the city council meeting on Tuesday demanding basic, first of all, the restoration of civil rights for activists like yourself and myself who are barred from the city council area. We're actually barred from the entire city council complex 24 hours a day, according to the injunction. And when I spoke to attorney David Beauvais last night, he's the attorney who's advising us, he told me that no matter what the city attorney tells us verbally or even writes down, the injunction is the injunction. It says you can't come to these meetings. If we come to these meetings, we risk being arrested and found in contempt of court, regardless of what the city attorney says, even though he's the plaintiff and he is the city attorney. I should say Anna Brooks is the plaintiff, but he's the law firm that is carrying this Miss Brooks complaint about us, which, as I said, is, in my view, Fitzmaurice's clear attempt to disperse this protest. What's your view, Bernard? I know you're named on this injunction, too.
Well, I think I'm getting away from the subject here on Ann Porter. I think that was instigated by Fitzmaurice. You know, if you look at objectively what I was doing over that time, I was very, very kind to Anna Brooks. I know that she doesn't really have anything on me.
Why would they go after you? I just don't understand that. I mean, you are one of the most mild, inoffensive fellows I know. You are very soft-spoken. You brought your son on occasion with you. I don't recall her ever complaining to you about anything, do you? I don't remember.
The only thing that she's ever complained to me was, you know, she's told me, you know, that Mr. Klitzner, you know, these consul people, they only make telephone appointments through the telephone, and I've told you that repeatedly. I think that was the only thing that she was ever, you know, frustrated with me about that I'm aware of.
And she was wrong on that issue.
Well, she may be, but
Right, I mean, she was wrong. You can walk up to the council and leave them a note. The notepad specifically provides for ways of getting at the council members in terms of getting information to them other than by telephone. You can come in and leave them a note.
Well, I think you're right, Robert, but you asked me...
Right, that was the only time in which she complained about your behavior.
As far as I know.
Yeah. Well, it looks like the city attorney and the mayor sat down and cooked this one up with Anna. I mean, Anna is, you know, she's... Miss Brooks is a... I call her Anna because that's what she prefers to be called, and that's what I've always called her, and that's, I'm sure, what I'll continue to call her. You know, she and I have had our differences of opinion as it comes up. You know, I mean, she's in a kind of a friction point because the mayor, you know, is in the middle. She's in the middle between the mayor and us, and we, you know, we didn't ask for that. But, you know, she has to take the messages. She has to take the phone calls. She does have an office that has more people in it than she's used to, one or two more people, and that shouldn't be a great problem, but it's, I suppose, you know, for a person who is frankly very, you know, controlling and wants to see everything proceed in a very specific way, that can be kind of frustrating. And I think, and frankly, that's the kind of person that I've noticed she seems to be. But that's all going to be discussed in court. And actually, I'm going to be playing some tapes now. And I did promise I'd be playing this transcript of Tim Fitzmaurice. I'm actually hoping that we can actually get the actual tape of Tim Fitzmaurice talking to students and telling them why he's doing nothing about the sleeping ban, which is quite eye-opening.
Susanna
Haberman.
Hey, what's troubling me, too, is that in the affidavit, you know, they didn't even, they don't even want Suzanne, they didn't call for Suzanne to give any testimony, and she was...
Yeah, Suzanne Haberman is the other administrative assistant.
She's seen everything that was going on.
Right. Well, it could be that you know, I like to take the positive view that she didn't want to be a part of this hoax. But frankly, they may just be holding her testimony in reserve. They can always pull out another declaration. You know, I noticed that you and I, and I think your point is well taken, Bernard, that we were talking about Ed Porter's position on the sleeping ban. We're getting diverted here. You know, that's interesting. We get diverted into these defending ourselves in court. I mean, when somebody claims you're harassing a woman in a public position repeatedly and that gets smeared all over the newspapers, it's something that you really have to respond to. But, of course, the energy we spend responding to that takes away from what we're really trying to respond to, which is this criminal failure, this malfeasance by the city council in terms of endless harassment of the homeless under the city's institutionalized hate crime, which is the sleeping ban law. At least that's my view. Anything you have thoughts on that?
No.
You probably have lots of thoughts on that.
No. I'll talk to you later.
Hey, thanks, Bernard.
Bye-bye.
And this is still Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And you are still able to reach us at 427-3772, and I encourage you to do that. I'm going to cue up a song or two. I guess I read you Ed Porter and Emily Riley, two of our four new city council members' statements to the Green Party. The real question is now, why isn't the Green Party showing up and dealing with these issues? And there's been rumors afoot that a coup is in progress to essentially oust David Silver from his position of power in the Green Party. I don't know if this has a lot of substance. I've heard it repeatedly mentioned, so there may be more substance to it. I hope it doesn't happen. I think certainly on the sleeping ban issue, David is a clear light on this issue. He and I have not always agreed on tactics on this issue, and we have differences of opinion there. I think activists have to maintain solidarity and not be drawn into negotiations apart. But David has been very passionate on the issue and tried for many years to get this issue resolved. Still is. He announced he's continuing his fasting attempts on this and to get a fast together on this issue, which I think was, along with the rest of us, successful in getting the city council to take the first timid steps last May when they started looking at the safe sleeping zones. I've also got a great book here that I want to recommend to everybody who's interested in the struggle to restore homeless rights or to restore rights for people who happen to be outside. It's called Rising Up, Class Warfare in America from the Streets to the Airwaves by Richard Edmondson. And it's about free radio, too. Richard Edmondson is one of the seminal voices in free radio in San Francisco. He started San Francisco Liberation Radio around the same time that Stephen Dunifer of Berkeley, Carol Denny of Berkeley, and others were working to establish micropower radio by kind of surreptitiously broadcasting from the hills of Berkeley and the hills of San Francisco. And Richard Edmondson in this book, which I'm going to be reviewing for Street Spirit newspaper, talks about how the homeless struggle, he lived in a van himself, and his participation with Food Not Bombs in San Francisco led him to free radio as a way of getting truthful information out when all the media was lying. And we have that same problem here in Santa Cruz. And perhaps we still have the same problem, even with free radio, because we don't know, I've never known how many people are listening to this station, though apparently the city authorities do listen to my show somewhat, sometime, and I was even cautioned by my attorney before I went on the air today not to be too expose our entire legal strategy here, and as an attorney, that's good advice. Of course, the problem I have is it's really important to get real news out to people, and I'm always telling people who are going into court situations to try to be as open as they can about what's happening, even though their attorney wants them to keep everything shut down until the day after the decisions and all that sort of thing. Because what we're really doing here is trying to end the sleeping ban and trying to restore basic rights for people. And that is the primary objective. Whether I am banned from City Hall or not is not the main issue. I mean, it certainly is a main issue, because for any activist, that's a very terrible threat. It means I can't research records. It means I can't make phone calls to the city council offices. It means I can't drive by the city council offices. I can't use a part of the library. I can't walk. I can't use a civic auditorium. All because Mayor Fitzmaurice doesn't want to deal with the sleeping ban issue and is using his administrative assistant, Anna Brooks, as a cat's paw here. It's a sad situation. And in a way, however, it gives us an opportunity to kind of research and to explore what happened during the city council coffee clutch. For instance, I talked to Chris Congleton, and he kind of had some thoughts on the issue. Chris is a man who is a teacher for Bayside Children's College, it's called. That's a sort of a children's school. Children aged 7 to 18, actually, so it's quite a large span. He is also a member of a group called Humanity Now, and he invited me to one of his weekly meetings. I've discussed that on the air a couple months ago after the election, and they were kind of interested in hearing about the sleeping ban, and the more they heard, the more curious and concerned they became, and they went to the November 28th council meeting where we had a protest. And then he brought his students to the city council offices to watch and to speak with the mayor and various council members, see how the council runs. They weren't initially involved in the protest. And I spoke with them in the corridor outside the council offices and introduced them to Emily Riley and to Martine Bernal, who's the assistant city manager. The atmosphere was congenial, and I'm kind of looking at some of the notes he made on this. He said that my students asked questions and received answers from both of them. I went inside the council offices where one or two people were sitting peaceably. He asked to Miss Anna Brooks to schedule an appointment with Mayor Fitzmaurice, and Miss Brooks dealt with him. And I'm only reading some of these notes. Mayor Fitzmaurice graciously and promptly scheduled a meeting for a week or two later with him, another teacher, Linda Esperanza, and a few of their students. And they spoke with him for about an hour, that is to say the students, Chris Congleton and Linda Esperanza, about many things, most notably the sleeping ban and the possibility of an emergency repeal of the ban this winter. According to Chris, Mayor Fitzmaurice himself brought up the name of Mr. Norris and expressed restrained hostility towards him. He stopped himself in mid-sentence occasionally in order to seemingly avoid saying something negative about Mr. Norris. One of the students was making a tape recording of the conversation with Mr. Fitzmaurice's permission as part of a school project. Even knowing that the conversation was being recorded, Fitzmaurice said that Norris was a confused man who was ineffective, doing more harm than good. And after the conversation, which happened in Mayor Fitzmaurice's office, Chris says he stopped in the foyer to speak with Mr. Norris, while my students and Ms. Esperanza spoke with another one of the administrative assistants, Suzanne Haberman. At this point, Mr. Fitzmaurice emerged from his office and asked Mr. Norris to please take this meeting outside, spoke to Mr. Norris in an agitated tone and seemed clearly upset. I was surprised, says Chris, because Mr. Norris and I have been speaking in normal voices. Mr. Norris and I then waited briefly for Ms. Esperanza and the children with her to finish their business with the administrative assistant and then went outside where we finished our conversation. Mr. Fitzmaurice seemed very intent, according to Chris, on getting Mr. Norris to leave the offices, though he wasn't sure why. At no time did I see, that's Chris, anyone speaking loudly or disruptively in the foyer or outside, although Mr. Fitzmaurice's determination to see Mr. Norris gone struck me as extreme. In the course of my conversation with Mr. Fitzmaurice, it became clear that he was uninterested in making what he called, quote, a politically unsuccessful choice to make any attempt to repeal the sleeping ban. In fact, he seemed uninterested in addressing any homeless issues at all over the winter. This was on December 13th. I realized Mr. Fitzmaurice was more devoted to continuing his political career than serving the community on this issue. And then, apparently the next day, he volunteered, that is, Chris volunteered to join the coffee clutch. He entered the office around 11, spent most of his time reading, was treated congenially by the staff, looked at public records, found Miss Brooks very helpful. She initiated conversation with him, and he kept a log of what happened. He never saw any hostility. And, of course, there wasn't generally any hostility between myself and any members of the coffee clutch and the staff. They were just there. But they became the excuse that Fitzmaurice used to run to a judge to get an illegal restraining order. That's the kind of thing they used to use to bust unions, the kind of things they used to close down protests, and that's what he's used. That's the Green Party mayor. And I really encourage Green Party members to call immediately 420-5017 and ask Fitzmaurice. I'd suggest he resign, frankly. I've seen him operating for 2 years. But if he doesn't want to, people don't want to get that radical because they think he is savable, I'd suggest they tell him to immediately reverse his position and deal with issues, not attempting to silence critics. Because that is what our mayor has been doing. There's a good issue of Street Spirit out. That's the newspaper that you can purchase from homeless people on the streets for a dollar. It's got a long article on Waiting for Justice by myself and Becky Johnson about kind of the early part of the City Council coffee clutch and what the City Council has and hasn't been doing, and that might interest you. And that's available through 423-HUFF, 423-4833. Let's take that that promised musical break. Oh, I'm having a little trouble getting the proper music queued up here. I'm still having a little bit of trouble. But hang with us. We will do the queuing. I didn't hear most of Steve Argue's show on Saturday. Steve Argue is a political activist who's been fighting the sleeping ban, ran for city council, was jailed for 7 months on essentially bogus charges, who has his own radio show from 12 to 3 on Free Radio every Saturday. And particularly of interest was the Citizens Police Review Board final report on the only complaint that has ever received an independent investigation. And that is a whole series of complaints, actually. If you count them, there are, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23 complaints regarding the May 22nd, 1999 police riot, if you want to call it that, mini riot, I don't know what the proper term is, inappropriate police behavior against a protest, largely peaceful protest, somewhat tumultuous but peaceful nonetheless, which was protesting the bombing of Yugoslavia and the local Democratic Party hacks holding a fundraiser in the middle of all this with Representative Sam Drop Those Uranium Depleted Weapons Far, the main speaker. So this report, I think Steve did an analysis of it on his show. I just got a copy of it on Friday, and there are a number of interesting findings. I think it's worth reading through for those of you who weren't able to hear his show. I want to remind you, this took a year and a half to get this report. The main officer under the limelight, Officer David LaFavor, the one who grabbed this woman and child at this protest, has resigned. Again, I'll review what happened for those of you who may not remember, or this may be new to you. In May of 1999, there were about 50 to 100 people protesting outside the McPherson Center on Front Street across from Eric's Deli area, the bank area there, peacefully protesting, but indeed loudly protesting. And at one point, there was a complaint from inside that we were playing, some of us, well, one woman had a boombox, which was playing sounds of the bombing of Yugoslavia, and she sort of held it near the door of this black tie, tuxedo, fancy Dan function inside. And so police came and grabbed the wrong person, is what happened. At least that's what happened later in terms of the court records, that the woman who made the original complaint said, that's not the woman, you took the wrong person. And this woman, and her name is Go Ling Liao, was never convicted or even tried. Charges against her were dropped. However, this became a matter of great concern to people in the crowd who rushed after her as they dragged her off to the police van, or I should say hurried her off to the police van, and people surrounded the van on the street and said, what are you taking her for? The police wouldn't tell them, and don't let, by the way, police tell you that that's a privacy issue. Go Ling wanted people to know what she was being taken away for, but of course they didn't say. And because they didn't say, people stayed there and grew angrier. Well, there was a woman with a child in her arms who was surrounding this van. Perhaps not the best tactical choice for that woman. But Officer David LaFavor, instead of going to other people, went directly to her and demanded she leave, and then began pulling her and the child away. And Steve Argue intervened because this Officer LaFavor was using a pain compliance hold on this woman that seemed to threaten her holding of the child. This was a five-year-old girl. Another officer, Tripp, did a similar number with Julianne, that was the woman's name's companion, Almond, who had a two-year-old child who was kind of sitting around his shoulders. And the protesters were concerned that this is a completely inappropriate attack going to the people with the kids first. Instead, there were no warnings given, no announcements made, and it was bad police practice. Of course, nobody ever heard a word of it in terms of the media. There was never an investigation by the city council. The police department was not directed to change its policies. No, instead what happened was they spent $10,000 on an independent investigation of charges around this, which was ruled by the city attorney a confidential document. So I don't have that investigation. All I have are the recommendations of the Citizens Police Review Board to the police chief, who can, of course, ignore them and probably will. We do know that David LaFavor left the force. What happened, again, I didn't really finish the story. Steve Argue punched David LaFavor in the nose as he was doing this pain compliance hold on Julien, after urging him to stop, and he wouldn't stop, so he punched him. Steve then ran. Lefebvre followed him, grabbed him, forced pepper spray down his throat, what one might call a lethal assault, but luckily it wasn't lethal. Roughed up Argue, took him off to jail, and Argue then was eventually convicted in a grotesque scene where half the police force, or a third of the police force, in uniform, on police time and your money, sat in the courtroom watching. So it's sort of the other side of Fitzmaurice's injunctions and his cutting off people's, you know, at city council from oral communication, and Sugar's directing the police to take people away because they bring up a golden porta potty award, as I did. It's the other side of this repressive phenomena where the police themselves show their naked force and the city council does nothing to restrain them. Well, we have this report which came out. I'm going to read you what the results were. The complaint was neglect of duty, failure to make adequate announcements and warnings, and who did it? Well, they were, quote, confidential. They actually weren't confidential. What that meant was that the people who made the complaint did not say they wanted their names released to the media. This is the kind of misleading form that people have when they file these complaints. It doesn't say, do you want your name released to people who are asking who you are so they can contact you later to get more information. It says, do you want your name publicly released to the media? A lot of people don't particularly want to announce themselves to the media, but they wouldn't mind having their names on public record if another person wanted to talk to them, let's say. But I've, for 7 years, tried to get that changed with no success because this form was written by the police department. And, of course, most of what the CPRB does is police department endorsed. I mean, they have their problems with the CPRB. I'm sure they prefer not to have them there. But they also continue a fairly close association with them. They have, they are not challenged in any way in terms of public hearings. Police officer has never been subpoenaed to a Citizens Police Review Board hearing. So there is that kind of close approach. Anyway, neglect of duty, failure to make adequate announcements and warnings. This was sustained. I was quite surprised to see this. That means our CPRB board told the police department, you didn't make adequate announcements and warnings. And it was sustained on a vote of 3-2. Interesting. The board is 7 people. I don't know who they are. And it's strange we don't get to see their names here. I'd like to know who did what on these complaints. I bet my bottom dollar that Jim King was one of the no's, but I don't know. The comment on this is the board sustains that portion of the confidential complaints alleging failure to make adequate announcements and warnings for the demonstrations prior to initial arrest, not regarding an order to disperse for illegal assembly. So, in other words, they said that there was inadequate announcements prior to the first arrest, but that later on the police did say, move away from the van or we'll have you arrested. But, of course, the people were there at the van because of the initial illegal arrest to start with, the arrest that never went to court. Let me read it. So that's the first one. The second one, the second complaint was conduct reflecting discredit. Selective enforcement was used to escalate the protest. Again, the same two confidentials plus Becky Johnson and attorney Ed Fry made that complaint. Their finding was unanimous, unfounded. Unfounded is the lowest kind of... if somebody is really telling tall tales, you call their complaint unfounded. The next level up is exonerated, means there's some evidence. The next level up is not sustained. There's more evidence, but not enough. And the final level is sustained. Then the next one was unwarranted action. The custodial arrest of Go Ling Liao was unwarranted. And people who complained were Becky Johnson, Peter, Vincent O'Reilly, one confidential, Stephen Argue, and Vincent Lombardo. The findings were unanimous that this was unfounded. And I kind of, how could they do that when they arrested the wrong person? They arrested a person who was not the person that they dropped all charges against. Or I guess you can say they felt they had probable cause to arrest that person. And that's probably
they were being told all along that she was the wrong person by the woman in charge of the museum.
Aha. Well, we actually have in the studio that interloper and sometime injunction watcher, Scott Graham. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Robert. As I was saying behind the mic here, was that they actually arrested the wrong woman, and the woman in charge of the museum, who could tell them, yes, you can start arresting people, actually kept on telling them, you're arresting the wrong woman, and the police arrested her anyway.
Caller, you're on the air.
I believe it was an infraction that Goeling was charged with, and why didn't they just write her a ticket?
Good question. And the answer to that may lie in the latest round of in federal court that's happening between Steve Argue and his attorney, Kate Wells, and the city attorney, John Barrasoni, on another case.
Sorry about that, caller. That the police are now, the city attorney is now contending that there are some infractions you can arrest people for. And that's sort of new to me, although I've heard sort of a, they've kind of varied their story over the years, the police department, about when you can arrest for an infraction. But my understanding before the last orientation session several years ago, when both the public defender and the Art Danner, then district attorney, showed up, was that you can't arrest someone for an infraction. You can write them a ticket, and if they refuse to sign the ticket, well, or that's itself a misdemeanor, they can claim, or they can, actually, if they refuse to sign the ticket, it's not a misdemeanor, but that means there has to be a custodial. They have to take you into custody and take you to a magistrate and that sort of thing. So, but they are now claiming in this latest lawsuit with Steve Argue and Kate Wells, which involves not this case, but a previous selling a street newspaper case and being thrown to the ground for it and held for 4 days illegally for it, that you can make an arrest on an infraction. And this, of course, I believe, is not been my understanding of the law. But, of course, laws change, and, of course, people's interpretations of laws change. I hadn't heard that this particular law had changed. The board, however, in the case of this, the custodial arrest of Gao Ling Liao was unwarranted. The board believes the arrest of Goeling was a poor decision. Still, they unanimously endorsed the police arrest, even though, as Scott said, they continue to be told by this one of the employee who was making the complaint. Now, Scott, where did you hear this directly from the employee, or did you hear this sort of about out and about? Where did you?
I heard this at the trial of Steve Argue when the woman in charge of the museum testified in court under oath, saying that she kept on telling the police that they were arresting the wrong person.
So, you still have the Citizens Police Review Board unanimously throwing out, not just as unsustained, not just as exonerated, but unfounded, the idea that the custodial arrest of Goeling Liao was unwarranted. But then they give you this weenie addition. That is to say, they whine a bit. They say the board believes the arrest of Goeling Liao was a poor decision. However, lack of conclusive evidence and confusion as to whether or not adequate warnings were given led to this finding and to the belief that Liao had been warned, that had Liao been warned, she would have complied and no arrest would have been made. Again, they're talking about Liao as though she was the guilty party. And in fact, according to the court testimony, this was not the person in question. So,
well, that's part of the problem, is that the Citizens Police Review Board relies entirely on the information given to them by the police. And so the police are not going to give them testimony that was heard in open court to substantiate that they made a mistake.
But remember, Scott, this was the one case in the entire history of the Citizens Police Review Board where there was a $10,000 independent investigation.
Right. I think that investigation concluded prior to Goeling being exonerated and prior to Steve's trial finishing.
You know, I think that you may be wrong about that. I think the investigation concluded in December, and I think these exonerations happened in October. But I could be wrong myself. I don't exactly have a clear sense of that.
But I have no idea, as probably no one else that doesn't have privy to this thing, whether or not any of this court testimony and the facts that Goeling was released from all charges by the court was ever in any of this.
Right, we don't know. And, of course, one of the whole points of having an independent investigation is to be able to see the process, to participate in the process, to examine the documents, and, in essence, to be reassured that this isn't some kind of cover-up or, alternately, some kind of rush conviction.
Right. I mean, it'd be very easy for them to remove all the officers' names. Just say Officer A through Z and give each officer a letter of the alphabet and keep their names out of the thing and let the public read it.
Right, but they're claiming that the confidential personnel files, the access to those files has meant that there can be no revelation of this report. And for a while, the independent investigator Diana Christensen kind of toyed with the idea of not using those files, but simply subpoenaing the officers and getting independent testimony from them at a hearing. But the police review board wouldn't back her up on this. They were too nervous to deal with this. So we had a situation where there was no public hearing, no subpoenaing of officers. Instead, she went to the files, read the IA reports, and the city attorney then said, okay, then it all is confidential. You can't say a word about any of this stuff. So continuing, we're looking at the report of what the Citizens Police Review Board, after looking at the independent investigation and the police department's response to the independent investigation, one would have thought that they wouldn't give the independent investigation to the police department so that they'd get the police department's independent response and then compare the two and see who seemed to be telling the truth, what the inconsistencies were. So they didn't do that, though. What they did instead was they gave this report directly to the police department, the Citizens Police Review Board, and then the police department held it for 4 or 5 months and concocted their own report, which I think was supposedly 4 times as long as the independent investigation. So the whole background of this is troublesome, to say the least. And we're talking again about the May 22nd, 1999 incident where 5 people were arrested, Going Lau, Jim Costner, Vincent Lombardo, Nassim Zarifi, and Steve Argue. And 4 of those people have either served jail or gotten probation because of this whole incident, which could have been avoided had police behaved in a constitutional and appropriate manner. You know, I'm going to interrupt this discussion of this complaint because in the studio with me I have Chris Congleton, who is one of the infamous coffee clatchers, as well as, a teacher, a local teacher.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
And Chris, you, I dragooned you last night to write up a declaration for the hearing on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, is the hearing to make sure that we get our constitutional rights restored so we can begin again the process of trying to get some kind of action from City Council on the sleeping ban. What do you want to just briefly tell us a little bit about this? I know you're kind of in a hurry. You brought us an interesting tape recording, which has to do with the mayor's conversations with you and your students, but I've read some notes that you've made about what happened, and I think some of which may end up in court.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to just kind of tell us, give us a little summary of how things went, or how do you feel about that?
Sure. So I became interested in learning more about the city council and how our city government works. Just after the election, and I also thought since I'm going to be learning about this, I might as well bring some students along, because what better way to learn about governance or about civics than to actually go and meet the mayor, meet the city council, watch the process underway. So I made an appointment with the mayor and brought some students, and that morning when we arrived, Robert Norris and some other people were protesting the sleeping ban outside and inside the council offices.
Now, by protesting, do you mean agitating loudly, jumping up and down, and disrupting the business of the office?
No. By protesting, I simply mean that they were standing around with signs, willing to talk to anybody who wanted
standing
to
around blocking the egress to the office?
No.
Standing around alarming and overbearing toward the secretaries, perhaps?
Perhaps maybe just physically. I mean, you are a large man, but certainly not. You were calm and centered and more than polite. I mean, everyone was congenial
even the secretaries were congenial with you.
Did you hear the secretary saying, get this guy out of here, we can't work here, perhaps?
No.
Did you see Anna Brooks in tears on the edge of emotional trauma, as she said in her declaration?
Not at all.
Perhaps were we engaging in pilfering pens, stealing food, or otherwise, creating a property problem for the office?
You know, I'm not sure, Robert. I've only known you for a few...
You didn't pat me down for pens when you left. Yeah, boy, I got away with
but
that.
But I didn't directly observe anything of that sort.
Did you observe a loud level of conversation that would be such as to interfere with office business?
No. So the students and I walked in to speak with the mayor.
How many students were you?
I believe there were seven of us.
And these are youngsters or oldsters?
There was the youngest was 8, and the eldest, I believe, was 17. And we tape recorded this for a class project that someone was doing. Like, they helped transcribe the conversation, and we just used it to talk about issues of homelessness and issues of... How does a city deal with an issue like this, and what happens in different economic models politically, and how can things be done differently than they are in our country, in our city, and how can we make that happen?
An issue like this, you mean the sleeping ban?
Certainly. I mean, that's a prime example of the relationship between the powerful moneyed interests and the poor. And I think that it's a really strong catalyzing point between the two. And I think that's what I see happening. That's the real conflict I see happening between you and... I mean, from my perspective, I feel like Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice is the one who's having the conflict with you, and that his secretary is simply